The big tech news in this country, the iPhone and iPad. Despite some grumbling about drop calls and other glitches, these products are flying out of the stores with all their "the future is here now" glamour. But in other parts of the world, the simplest cell phone technology is also sparking innovation, allowing millions of people new ways to send email, pay bills, consume television and radio, and flirt at a fraction of the cost of products like the iPhone, BlackBerry, or Droid. In India, for example, companies have taken basic cell phone technology, which is now all but shunned in U.S. businesses, and added technological steroids to win an estimated 15 million new users each month. Anand Giridharadas has been reporting on the advances for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. He's a columnist for the Times, and he's writing a forthcoming book to be titled India Calling, and he joins us now from Mumbai. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So just give us a sense of the scope of this. In India, for example, how many people have a cell phone right now, have some access to mobile technology right now?
It's just over half the population, up from nearly nothing a few years ago. And it's just a remarkable growth story. And what's really important to understand for an audience in the United States is in the U.S., people will spend most of their day in front of a computer. For many Indians, the cell phone is not only a substitute for a computer, which most Indians still don't have, it may also be a primary alarm clock, primary music device. It may be the only source of private romantic correspondence they have for people who don't even have their own bedroom. And so it's this kind of all-in-one magical device that serves a larger-than-life role that almost no single piece of technology serves in the West.
Well, the UN says that something like there are like 445 million cell phones, and as you said, serving about 45% of the population, contrasting that with the fact that only 31% of the population has access to improved sanitation, those figures from 2008. Does that sound right to you?
That sounds right in India, and I think the UN put that out, but actually what I figured out when I was doing the reporting for my essay in the Times was that that's actually true globally. More people in the world have access to a cell phone today than have access to a flush toilet around the world.
What does the cell phone mean then for people who have not had access to just a lot of the sort of the creature comforts that many people in the West are accustomed to? What does a cell phone mean?
What it means is, in an increasingly aspirational world, people want to do the same things that everybody else does. So they want to bank on their phones, they want to find dates on their phones, they want to find jobs on their phones, they want to do the things that people do on computers in wealthier countries. And all they have on the supply side is a really simple phone. You can get a phone in India for about $15 and get it connected for another, you know, two or three. And what has happened as a result of that kind of supply-demand imbalance is that phone companies and other companies have come up with extraordinary innovations to do fairly complicated things like banking and getting people dates on really simple text-based phones that are totally not smartphones, just through basic text message technology.
One of the points you made in some of your coverage, which I've really enjoyed, is just that just how it upends kind of traditional relationships. The people who, as you say, might be sharing a bedroom with a sibling until they're in their 20s, until they can afford to get married and move out, can actually have a little bit more social privacy.
The way I put this in with regard to India, and I'm sure this is true elsewhere, is that a cell phone is really a bedroom. It's the first place where you can collect messages that no one else will read. It's the first number, just the fact of that number is the first individual identity that many people have, that they have access to 24 hours a day.
What do you think impact it will also have on the ability to negotiate with authority figures? Because traditionally one way that people have been, if I could use this term, kept in their place, is by denying them access to information. To say, oh, well, no, what, you can't have this loan because there are other people who got it, or you can't have this job because it's not available, or you can't have this place to live because it's already been rented. And I do have to wonder what access to this technology will do for people who want to upend those authority hierarchies.
And there's all kinds of different examples of that happening already. In India, there's been something called the No Criminals Campaign, in which some organizations got together and arranged it so that if any Indian text messaged their parliamentary district or their zip code, they'd get back a text message telling them the name of all the candidates running for parliament, their incomes, hoping to rat out corruption, any prior criminal convictions, those kinds of things. In Kenya, you had an organization called Ushahidi born with the opposite. It was crowdsourcing information from the public rather than giving the public information. It was asking people to report incidents of violence after the electoral clashes they had there. And from all those disparate pieces of data, they put together this extraordinary crisis map. And that technique that Ushahidi developed has become the main source of map data in the Haitian earthquake and then the Chilean earthquake, and now is being used in the Louisiana Gulf.
And I think it also is fair to mention, too, in Iran, with the protests after the elections last year, when the young woman was killed by a member of the security forces, her death was not only noted, was clearly noted by a person who had a camera there, but those pictures, those images were immediately translated around the world through people's cell phones.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I just spent some time in China recently, and I think in societies where you do have authoritarian government, whether the perception is right or not, I think ordinary people have a perception that computers are something that governments can really get into and catch you doing bad things on, and that phones are not. And I don't know if that turns out to be right, but I think people behave on that assumption, and it probably is true.
But to that end, though, I mean, these are all very new and burgeoning developments. Is there any sense of changes that have now become, you know, the expectation is that the changes will really be permanent? Or the, you know, you've talked about how, and you've written about how people can now do things like pay bills, they can use their phones to consume media, they can, you know, use them even as flashlights. I know we've certainly done that. But do you have a sense of where it's really in India, where you've spent a lot of your time, changing people's expectations of how they are to be treated, mainly by institutions and authorities?
I think if you look at a society like India, the reason it's so revolutionary is people, traditionally, the way the power structures have worked, people have been at the mercy of other people. And whether that means your maid being at the mercy of her employer, you know, remembering to tell her she didn't have to come in today so she didn't have to spend 2.5 hours on a bus, or whether it's the government taking its time to give you that document that you're entitled to but they just can't get around to giving you. And there are a million other examples like that. And a cell phone, just because of its directness, you have one at all times, and the people in power have one at all times. And everyone is assumed at a certain point to have one, and there's no excuses. It powerfully disintermediates all of those relationships. And it's pretty transformative for that maid or for that farmer looking for his land deed from the government to know, even just psychologically, that he can make your pocket vibrate at any hour of the day.
Before I let you go, you go back and forth quite a lot. What's the main thing you notice between the U.S. and India?
It's interesting. I think when I return to India, what I notice is, in some ways, there's an optimism and a dynamism. I think I'm also reminded whenever I return to India that it's going to be a long road and that life is still very, very hard as it's lived at the average. When I return to the U.S., I am always struck, contrarily, I don't think Americans appreciate certain things that work in the U.S., that no country is going to be able to replicate in the near term. No one is going to have the Ivy League universities or anything like them for a very long time. No one will have, you know, the number of really good radio stations and media organizations for a very long time. And people in places like India know that. Everyone still has their road ahead, but there's a lot left to savor in the U.S.
Anand Giridharadas is a columnist for the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune. His forthcoming book is called India Calling, and he called us from Mumbai. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Back to this country, just about everybody has heard about the digital divide, how Hispanics and blacks are supposedly lagging behind whites in this country in their access to the latest technologies. Well, not when it comes to mobile devices.
I do everything on my phone. I text, I talk, I BBM a lot. I Google banks, locations, internet. I send pictures, I receive pictures. You know, pretty much my life is on my phone.
Tune in tomorrow as we launch our series, Tell Me Mobile. We'll explore new research that suggests that minorities are outpacing white users when it comes to data applications on handheld devices. We'll ask whether cell phones are the great equalizer. That's on Wednesday.